Acatra Foundation presents the Acatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Acatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really significant figure in American history, John Adams.
Yes, the second president. Often overshadowed, but absolutely crucial.
Exactly. We're diving into his story, looking at his, you know, very human but vital contributions to America's founding. And we're doing this mainly through David McCullough's fantastic biography, John Adams.
Which won a Pulitzer, and for good reason. It's incredibly thorough.
Oh, absolutely. 751 pages, took him 7 years of research. He drew on over 1,000 letters between John and his wife, Abigail. It's just packed with detail.
It really is. And our mission today, I think, is to get past the sort of marble bust image and understand the man himself, what he did, yes, but also who he was.
Couldn't agree more.
What's so striking about McCullough's approach is how he makes Adams maybe the most, well, relatable of the founders.
That's interesting. How so?
Well, you think of Washington or Jefferson, and they almost feel like legends, right? Larger than life. But Adams, McCullough shows us his fierce integrity, sure, his honesty, his moral courage.
Key founding traits.
Absolutely. But also his deep struggles, his insecurities, his doubts. If you want to understand the messy, argumentative, gritty reality of building a democracy, Adams' life is sort of the perfect case study.
The human side of founding a nation.
Exactly. Profoundly human, definitely flawed, but utterly indispensable.
That really hooks you in, doesn't it? Humanity. So let's set the stage a bit more for everyone listening. John Adams, born 1735, died 1826. Statesman, diplomat, thinker, second U.S. president.
And he was there for practically everything, every key moment in the founding.
Yet, like you said, often feels overshadowed. The unsung hero compared to, say, Jefferson or Washington.
He really does. And McCullough's book is this massive act of biographical restoration, as it's been called, pulling Adams out of the footnotes, you know?
Putting him in the spotlight.
Right. Shining a full, brilliant light on him. The book shows this towering intellect, massive integrity, but also those crippling insecurities we talked about.
Yeah.
McCullough argues pretty convincingly that it was Adams's character, not charisma, that was the real bedrock of a republic.
Character over charisma. That's a powerful idea.
He calls Adams the pugnacious, principled, and often prickly conscience of the American Revolution.
Wow. Pugnacious, principled, and prickly. That sums him up perfectly.
Doesn't it, Jed?
So it really makes you wonder, how did this man become that figure? How did that prickly conscience get formed?
Yeah.
Can you paint a picture for us of his early life? Where did it all start?
Well, it didn't start in the planter aristocracy of Virginia. It started in Braintree, Massachusetts, 1735. Humble beginnings. Son of a farmer and shoemaker.
Very New England.
Very New England. Those Puritan values, hard work, education, moral seriousness, they were baked into him from the start. His father, John Sr., was a huge influence.
In what way?
He was the classic New England citizen farmer, a craftsman, farmed his land, served as a deacon, town leader. He really instilled in young John this belief in the dignity of labor, but also the responsibility of citizenship.
That makes sense.
And there's this great story McCall tells. Young John apparently wasn't keen on studying at first, preferred being outdoors.
A typical kid, maybe.
Maybe. But his father's response was interesting. Instead of forcing him, he took him out for a full day of backbreaking farm work, cutting thatch in the marshes, I think.
Oh, wow.
By the end of the day, apparently, young Adams was begging to go back to his books. It was a lesson, right? Education wasn't a chore. It was liberation from that kind of toil.
That's a fantastic anecdote, a defining moment, really. Education is freedom.
And he definitely took that lesson to heart. Ended up at Harvard College when he was just 15.
15.
Yeah, incredible. Immersed himself in Enlightenment ideas, classical studies. And it was there he kind of wrestled with his future. Family expected ministry, but he chose law.
His first big rebellion. In a way.
You could say that. A rebellion and an act of self-definition. Committing himself to a life in, well, the public sphere through law, not the pulpit.
And it's around this time, or soon after, that he meets Abigail Smith.
Right. They married in 1764. And Abigail, well, she's a whole other story, just as remarkable. Their letters, which McCullough uses so brilliantly, show she wasn't just a wife.
More than that.
Oh, much more. His intellectual equal, his most trusted advisor, his strategist, his emotional rock. She really was his conscience, too, and helped him through what McCullough calls his bouts of depression and self-doubt.
So their partnership was absolutely central.
The absolute pillar of his life. And amazingly, their bond seemed to get stronger even when they were separated by oceans for years during his diplomatic missions.
Incredible. So this foundation has laid pure in values, belief in law, this amazing partnership with Abigail. Then the tensions with Britain start escalating. Where does Adams first really step onto the public stage as a leader?
His voice really started getting heard with his writings against the Stamp Act in 1765. The dissertation on the canon and feudal law was a big one. He was fiercely articulate about American rights.
An intellectual leader first.
Yes, but then came a moment that tested his principles in a very real, very public way. The Boston Massacre trials in 1770.
Right, where he defended the British soldiers.
Exactly, a deeply, deeply unpopular decision. He risked everything, his reputation, his safety, but his conviction was absolute. The rule of law had to come before mob justice.
Facts are stubborn things, as he famously said.
Precisely. That act, that willingness to stand for principle even when it was dangerous and reviled, it cemented his reputation for, well, unshakable integrity. Even people who disagreed with him had to respect that. It showed what American liberty meant to him.
And from that point, he really throws himself into the cause, the Continental Congress.
Oh, absolutely. From 1774 to 78, he was tireless. McCulloch calls him the Atlas of American Independence. He was on countless committees arguing constantly for separation.
The driving force.
He really was. Jefferson might have held the eloquent pen for the Declaration, but Adams was the engine behind it, pushing, driving, making the case day after day.
And then, after the Declaration, his work wasn't done. He goes to Europe.
Right. Grueling diplomatic missions, often lonely, often frustrating. His direct, sometimes blunt style didn't always mesh well with, say, the smooth diplomacy of Benjamin Franklin.
I can imagine that clash.
Definitely. But his persistence was crucial. He secured a vital loan from the Dutch when things looked bleak, and he was key in negotiating the Treaty of Paris that ended the war. These weren't flashy jobs, but they were essential for the survival of the new nation.
So we have this picture of a man shaped by his upbringing, fiercely principled, willing to do the hard, unglamorous work. Let's dig into his core political thinking. What was his philosophy of governance based on?
At its heart, Adams had what McCulloch terms a pessimistic view of human nature.
Pessimistic?
Yeah.
How so?
He basically believed that people, they're easily corrupted by power, by passion, by self-interest. It's not that he thought people were evil, but he was deeply skeptical about unchecked human impulses.
So unlike some other founders who maybe emphasized inherent goodness.
Right. Adams built his ideas about government not on some lofty ideal of human perfection, but on the messy reality of human fallibility. And that's why he was so insistent on strong institutions, checks and balances.
To counter that fallibility.
Exactly. His work on the Massachusetts Constitution in 1780 is the prime example. Clear separation of powers, two legislative houses. It became a model for the U.S. Constitution later. He was terrified of the tyranny of the majority just as much as the tyranny of a king.
That's a really important distinction. Designing a government for real people, not angels.
Precisely. And central to that was his belief in the rule of law as like the pinnacle of civilization. But he wasn't just a theorist. McCulloch talks about his practical idealism, trying to apply these high principles in a world full of imperfect people. It was about making the system actually work.
Practical idealism. I like that. So what really drove him underneath it all? What were his core motivations?
McCulloch points to a few things. One was a passion for distinction or reputation, not just ego, but a deep desire for his work to matter, to contribute something lasting to the Republic.
A sense of legacy.
Yes. Then there was a profound sense of duty, straight from that Puritan background. An obligation to serve the public good, even if it cost him personally.
Which it often did.
It often did. And finally, this almost obsessive commitment to truth and integrity. He'd rather be right and unpopular than wrong and celebrated, as he basically said. That really tells you what his priorities were.
That's quite a statement, and probably not a recipe for easy political success then or now.
Definitely not.
So that commitment tells us a lot about Adams, the leader. But what about Adams the man? We touched on Abigail, his absolute rock. Can you elaborate a bit more on their relationship as McCulloch portrays it?
Their letters are just incredible. Spanning 50 years, they give us this amazing window, not just into their marriage, but into the whole revolutionary era. Abigail was absolutely his intellectual partner.
Debating ideas with him.
Oh, yes. Politics, philosophy, managing the farm while he was away for years. She advised him, challenged him, steadied him during those periods of doubt and depression he seemed prone to. This separation actually seemed to deepen their connection in many ways. It's a truly remarkable American partnership.
It sounds like it. And then there's his relationship with Thomas Jefferson. So complex.
Hugely complex. Brothers in arms during the Revolution, working side by side. Then their visions for the new country diverged sharply. Different ideas about government, about France, about finance.
Leading to bitter rivalry.
Intense rivalry. Competing for the presidency, attacking each other's policies and characters, often through proxies. It got ugly.
But they reconciled later in life.
Remarkably, yes. After years of silence, they started writing to each other again in retirement. That late life correspondence, 158 letters over 14 years, is just magnificent. Reflecting on their lives, their shared history, the meaning of it all. A truly moving reconciliation.
That's amazing. From brothers to rivals to, well, correspondence reflecting on it all.
And then you have the other end of the spectrum. His great nemesis, Alexander Hamilton.
Ah, yes. Not a reconciliation story there, I gather.
Not at all. Their conflict was deep and purely antagonistic. Philosophically, they clashed fundamentally. Adams feared concentrated power, especially executive power, and was wary of Hamilton's financial system and his pro-British leanings. Hamilton wanted a much stronger central government, a powerful executive.
And Hamilton actively worked against Adams.
Oh, absolutely. McCullough shows how Hamilton schemed behind the scenes to undermine Adams's presidency, especially his re-election bid in 1800. It fractured the Federalist Party and really poisoned the political atmosphere. A deep personal and political animosity.
So Adams is navigating these intense personal and political relationships while leading the country. His presidency must have been incredibly difficult.
Tumultuous is the word. The biggest issue looming over everything was the threat of war with France.
The quasi-war period.
Exactly. Triggered by the XYZ affair, where French agents demanded bribes just to negotiate. This outraged the American public. There was immense pressure, especially from Hamilton and his wing of the Federalist Party, to declare full-scale war.
But Adams resisted.
He did. It was probably the defining moment of his presidency. He believed war would be disastrous for the young nation. So against huge opposition from his own party, he pursued peace, sending another diplomatic mission.
Which ultimately succeeded.
It did succeed in avoiding war, but it was, as he knew it would be, political suicide. It split the Federalists wide open and was a major factor in his losing the 1800 election to Jefferson.
He put peace above party and his own career.
Absolutely. He later said he wanted his epitaph to read, "Here lies John Adams, who took upon himself the responsibility of the peace with France in the year 1800. That says everything about his priorities.
Wow. That's powerful. Of course, we also had to mention the Alien and Sedition Acts passed during his term.
Yes, you do. Passed in 1798 amid the war hysteria. They restricted immigration and made it a crime to criticize the government. They're rightly seen as the biggest stain on his legacy.
Even though born out of genuine fear.
The context was intense fear of foreign influence and internal dissent during a crisis. McCullough provides that context, but doesn't excuse the laws themselves, which were clearly repressive and violated the spirit, if not the letter, of the First Amendment.
A difficult chapter, for sure.
No question. But what's also fascinating is how Adams handled his bitter defeat in 1800. He didn't just fade away in anger. He had this remarkable recovery.
What did that look like?
A 25-year retirement back in Massachusetts, filled with reading, writing, farming, and importantly, that incredible renewed correspondence with Jefferson. It was a period of reflection, intellectual vigor, mending fences, and finding a measure of peace away from the political storms. It showed incredible resilience.
So looking back at this incredibly packed life, the principles, the struggles, the presidency, the retirement, why does John Adams still matter today? What's his enduring professional legacy?
Well, professionally, it's huge, even if sometimes subtle. His commitment to the rule of law is foundational. His willingness to accept defeat in 1800, ensuring a peaceful transition of power despite the bitterness, set an absolutely critical precedent.
Things we almost take for granted now.
Exactly. And there are specifics, too. He's considered the father of the U.S. Navy, understanding, despite his desire for peace, that the nation needed to protect its interests. And his appointment of John Marshall as Chief Justice right at the end of his term.
A midnight appointment.
Right. It had enormous long-term consequences, shaping American law for decades by strengthening the judiciary. These were strategic, nation-building acts.
That's a really important dimension. And what about his human legacy? What can we as individuals take from his life?
I think his human legacy is incredibly powerful. Adams shows that, you know, ordinary Americans could achieve extraordinary things through hard work, education, and principled service. He wasn't born into greatness. He earned it.
Relatable, as you said at the start.
Very. His life is a testament to integrity over popularity, to the importance of lifelong learning he never stopped reading and thinking, and to resilience, bouncing back from setbacks and defeats. He proves you don't need to be perfect or universally loved to make a profound difference. Substance matters more than style.
That feels especially relevant now, doesn't it, in our often polarized times?
It really does. His example of principled service, his willingness sometimes to work with opponents or at least engage with their ideas, like with Jefferson later, and his belief that democracy needs educated, engaged citizens. These are timeless lessons.
The way he and Jefferson reconnected is particularly striking.
Absolutely. That correspondence shows that even after the most bitter disagreements, former opponents can find common ground and mutual respect. It's a powerful reminder that dialogue and reconciliation are possible and vital for a healthy republic, a message we could certainly use today.
What a journey. Adams once wrote, "I must study politics and war, that my sons may have liberty to study mathematics and philosophy." That really captures the sense of sacrifice for the future, doesn't it?
It does. And it leads to a final thought, perhaps. John Adams's life constantly reminds us that real leadership often means making tough calls that you know will be unpopular in the moment, but that you believe are right for the long run.
Paying the price for principle.
Exactly. And it makes you ask yourself, doesn't it? How often are we, in our own lives, in our communities, willing to pay that price for our principles? It's definitely something worth thinking about.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.